Hi, I'm Barb. I'm a compulsive overeater.
Hi, Barb.
You can call me Fletch, too. It doesn't matter. Some people call me Fletch, other people don't. But I'm glad to be here tonight. And it's kind of funny because today, earlier in the day, I was having a really bad day. I was just having one of those days when it was just not very spiritual and things were not working very well. And so kind of being asked to speak, I'm like, okay, better get your shit together. We might have to edit that a little bit. But anyway, so I'm going to tell you about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And first of all, I'm going to read my favorite prayer, which is the seventh step prayer. And it goes like this. My Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen. So the reason why this prayer is like my favorite prayer, there's quite a few reasons, but one of the main reasons is that when I first came into program, I couldn't have said that prayer and meant any words of it. I really couldn't have. I mean, I did not want anyone, much less God, to know my bad parts. You know, I wanted everybody to think I was only good, and I was perfect, and you'd better believe it, and if you said anything to the contrary, I would be mad. And the second part of it were, I pray that you now remove every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness. I had no concept of that either. I prayed for things like parking spaces, and it was like the God of when things get really bad and you really, really don't know what else to do, then I would pray. But I didn't have any concept of usefulness to God and to my fellows, and I also didn't have any real idea of what God's will, doing God's will, meant. So I'm going to talk about the prayer, and I'm going to go back in time and tell you about what it was like and kind of bring you up to speed about what happened, and then kind of talk about the prayer a little more and then get into what's going on now. And so when I was, before I was even born, things were bad. I was like, okay, so my mom and dad, bless them, they have a lot of good points, but I'm going to tell you what it was like for me. My dad was abandoned by his family when he was 3, and his brother was 2, and they were taken in by their aunt and uncle, who let them stay in the barn. Not kidding. They were in the barn while their cousins were in the house, and they were like the cheap help, and they had no idea. My dad didn't have any idea of what it meant to be a father or what it meant to be a husband or a family. And he was a self-made man. He put himself through college. He got a college degree. He was very intelligent and he was very personable, but he just didn't have much social understanding of family. And my mom, her dad died when she was 16, and she had been like mother to the 7 younger children in her family, and she was Miss Busybody of the Year, kind of. And the two of them got together, my mom and my dad, and my dad just figured my mom knew how to be around kids because she had those brothers and sisters, so he deferred to her in all things to do with my sister and I. Well, my sister was born 1 year and 3 days before me, so she was born in the early 50s, and she weighed 3 pounds and 2 ounces, and she was in an incubator for over a month, and she almost died, and then she came home, and then she got pneumonia, and she went back in the incubator. So by the time she got home, she had been in an incubator for more than 2 months, and she showed kind of like autistic-like behavior. She went around and would like bite on the nails that were on the floor, things like that. And my mom knew something was wrong, but her doctors kept saying, no, nothing's wrong, just, you know, you're just sensitive, you know, don't worry about it. Well, my sister was actually legally blind from too much oxygen in her incubator, and that was part of what was wrong. And I think then the isolation in the incubator made her have more problems. But my mom found out she was pregnant with me when, you know, like my sister and I are only a year and 3 days apart. So 9 months, if you go, my sister was just a baby when my mom found out that she was pregnant with me. And she told me, in her own words, that, oh boy, now I'll have somebody to take care of this child who has problems. So before I was even born, I was taking care of my mother. And when I was born, I definitely was taking care of my entire family from the get-go. You know, I was supposed to help my sister. I was supposed to deny that my sister had any problems. I was supposed to make her look good. I was supposed to make my dad be happy when he came home from work, because if he was grumpy, then that was made everybody upset. And my mom really never, ever had an idea that I was a separate human being from her. So I had all sorts of problems as a child. And it's really, I think, a pretty horrible way to grow up, to feel like your worth is really just very much dependent on doing things for other people, but not on the fact that you are who you are. So when I left home, I left home at 18. My parents said, you have to leave. There was no anything about it. There was no help from, they did not help me with school. They did not care where I went. Just leave. So when I, you know, did leave and was wandering around trying to do things for myself, I didn't know what I liked. I didn't know who I was. I had no idea who I was because I had never, you know, I had just never explored that because it was all about everyone else in my family. And so when I became an adult and was on my own, I was like, I was clueless. I was so clueless, and I was just totally unable to function in that as myself. I could only function if I was helping somebody else. And so, you know, basically my early adulthood, I, you know, hooked up with people who needed help, basically, or who I felt needed help, or who I could be very codependent with, and I just got worse and worse. I didn't really have too many problems with food. My mom and dad were both alcoholics. My dad was a binge drinker who had these huge mood swings. If he wasn't drinking, he was depressed and wouldn't talk to you. If he was drinking, then he was chatting to you and wanting you to, you know, listen to his music and stuff like that. But it was all about, you know, it was all in that drunken, kind of weird, whatever you call it. It wasn't like he was interested in talking to you. My mom used to drink to try to keep up with my dad, and then she became an alcoholic. And she was the major alcoholic in the family. And she was also a compulsive overeater. So, you know, everything about in our family was about food. And my parents would drink, you know, on the weekends. And I remember I would just go to bed because I just want to get away from them. And I was never a kid who wanted to stay up late anyway. I always was tired and wanted to go to bed. I think a lot of it was just escape into away from them and their drinking. So that was going on in my life also. And so the first person I married, my first husband, was an alcoholic. And, you know, I thought it was normal to pass out on the couch at 8 o'clock every night. I really did. I had no idea that that was abnormal, honestly. If you can imagine thinking that that's normal. And I remember I went to nursing school, and about, you know, like second semester or third semester in nursing school, we had this lecture on alcoholism, and I'm like, oh my God, that's my entire family. You know, I didn't know. It was like, and then what do you do once you know, you know? And it's just so awful thinking, oh my God, what have I done? But, and I remember when my mom was severely alcoholic, and she could no longer eat anything. She would throw up if she ate anything, any food, but she could still drink. And she was a nurse also, and, you know, she was trying to work. She was trying to go to work. And you know what? At a certain point, you just have to have a certain amount of alcohol in your system no matter what. And so I was, like, petrified that she was going to get fired or she was going to make some kind of horrible mistake at work. But all this was happening, and what happened was she went to her therapist, and then she called me and said, I'm going into treatment. And then is when I was upset. I was not, you know, I was upset that she was, I saw that she was getting worse and worse, but I could handle that. This is how the sick the disease is. When she got help is when I freaked out. Honestly, when she went into treatment, I freaked out totally. And so that's, you know, that's another, I guess that's pretty typical for an alcoholic family, but that's kind of the way it was. So I had a friend in, we're skipping forward now to when I finally found OA, and I had a friend in graduate school who kept saying, oh, I should go back to OA. Oh, I should go back to OA. I'm like, well, what is that OA thing? You know, and she told me about it, and I'm like, oh. So I waited a while, and she was saying, oh, I should go back to OA. And then finally one day I thought, I'm going to go. And my problems with food got worse, you know, as my life went on. And they were not so bad when I was young. I would overeat, and I had, you know, horrible self-image and horrible body image. I always thought I was fat no matter how much I weighed. You know, I could weigh 125 pounds, and I thought I was horribly obese. And I did a lot of exercising, although not really, I never felt like it was too purposefully to lose weight, but it was so I could maintain, kind of. And what happened to me was menopause, really. I went into menopause when I was fairly young. I was 40. And all of a sudden, everything, I felt like my entire body changed. It was like feeling like, kind of like your body has sabotaged you or something. It's the weirdest feeling. Like, I never liked sweets ever in my entire life. You know, I would eat them every once in a while, but I didn't care about them. I was a chipper. You know, if there was anything I had to let go of, it was the chips. And when I was a little kid even, I would eat potato chips to the point where I'd get sick. I would make myself ill. I would eat so many. But I never cared about the candy. And I would take my Halloween candy and I would save it until my sister ate all of her candy. And then I would say, well, what do you want for this candy? If I give you this candy, what would you like for it? So I'd barter, get all these other things for the candy. So, but when I went into menopause, all of a sudden, it's the sweets started making me crazy, and I was just, like, uncontrollable. And I remember it was at the time I was working as a hospice nurse, so I was in my car, you know, and I'd go to, like, see 4 patients a day. Well, I'd start up the day, I'd go get coffee. And then while I was getting coffee, I would get, like, a couple of scones and maybe a couple cookies. And then I would think, well, I should get bagels for Justin. I should get some bagels for Justin. So I would go next door to the bagel place, and I would get a dozen bagels, plus some more, like, muffins and things like that. I would just have all this food in my car, and I would eat all of it. I would not have any bagels to bring home to Justin. I would have eaten them all. And that was just my first patient. You know, that was before the first patient. Then between maybe the second and third patient, I would go have lunch, and I would go get, like, a huge sandwich and a large thing of chips and, you know, just unbelievable amounts of food. But I had never, like, really wanted really big portions of food and or the sweets like I did when I just went into menopause. So my eating was kind of out of control, and I really put on the weight like crazy. And so I was getting heavier and heavier and thinking, you know, it's just kind of a weird time in your life when you're going through menopause. You think, well, you know, I'm getting old now, and so who cares? Who cares if I'm fat, really? As long as I'm happy, who cares? And so I tried to be happy. You know, I tried to think, okay, you know, 250, who cares, you know? Well, the problem is I wasn't happy. I was not happy. I was obsessed. And one of the times I remember, I was at school, and this is kind of a typical thing I would do. I was at school, and I was thinking about what I was going to have for dinner. And so I would think, okay, so we'd go to the store, and I would get, like, two large pizzas. I would get a large loaf of French bread and some cheese and some potato chips or some kind of chippy thing. And then we'd have to have cookies and then, you know, soda and stuff. Then I would throw in a couple bags of lettuce. You know, those lettuce bags, little salad bags. I would throw them in. so things looked a little bit better. And then I would go home and I would make the pizzas and I would eat like half of one before Justin even got home. I would eat that and some bread and some chips and some cheese and, you know, I'd actually be full before he even got home, but then that would not stop me from eating dinner. I would eat dinner on top of that. And I was just miserable. And, you know, the misery of it is just the physical misery of being so full and so overstuffed. And then realizing that you ate more on top of it a couple hours later is just enough to make you want to do something. And then, you know, the feeling of having to go to bed because you're so full and you've got so much food in you, you can't do anything but just, like, lay down. So by the time I got to OA, I was, like, really happy to be there and very discouraged about everything at the same time when I was first walked in. So, but I walked in, it was in April, and it was in this church meeting room, and there was probably about five or six people there, and I remember thinking, these people are crazy. What in the heck am I doing here? But there was nothing else I could do. I had already by that point done, I was a lifetime member of Weight Watchers. I was a lifetime member of Jenny Craig. I had tried the diet center. I had done two medical fasts. I had done every diet known to man and been quite successful, but never able to keep the weight off by that point. So at that point, I knew, you know, there was something I had to do that was, you know, going to be different. So, and the other thing about me that, you know, and this is just my story, but about 5 years before I went to OA, I went into counseling. And I had been in counseling since about the time that my mom got into treatment. But I had kind of gotten in and out of counseling. And I finally decided that this cognitive behavioral therapy was not for me. I just didn't like it. I wanted to do, like, deep therapy. These little band-aids on the OWI didn't work for me. I knew I needed, like, a major rehaul if I was ever going to be okay. So I went and found a therapist who did that kind of work, and I went into therapy for, like, 5 years. And this was pretty intensive, and I know a lot of people, number one, can't do it, can't afford it, or can't take the time, or don't want to do it, but I was blessed in that I had a husband who would let me. He said, you know, I'm not thrilled about you spending all this money on therapy, but, you know, I can see it's helping you. So, you know, so I went to therapy, like, at least 3 days a week for about 3 years, and then I cut back a little bit. But, I mean, that's what I needed to do. I kind of needed to grow myself up from the get-go. So, and it took like about 5 years of therapy. And finally one day I was sitting in Barbara's, my therapist's name is Barbara, which is kind of funny, all these Barbs. But anyway, I said, you know, I eat on the way over here and I eat on the way home, and, you know, I'm eating all the time, and we talked about what to do. And I said, I think I want to try OA. And she said, well, you know, it's okay if you want to try it, but, you know, whatever. She was okay with it. She's never been, like, totally a supporter of the 12-step programs, but she also taught me, one of the things she taught me was to be more assertive for what I want and what I think is right for me. And so if I tell her, I think this is right for me, even though you don't believe in it, or you don't, you know, totally believe in it, she's okay with me saying that and doing it. So anyway, so I ended up finally in that room in April and thought the people were crazy, but I thought, well, I'm going to keep coming back because I don't know what else to do. And I got a sponsor after about a month and started working the steps. And I always felt like I wanted to work the steps because when I was in therapy, I remember telling Barbara that I really needed a spiritual path. Like, that was missing in my life. And I had been raised Catholic, and there are tons of things that happened to me as a child that would make me never want to be a Catholic again. But, I mean, just all sorts of things. But anyway, But I missed that spiritual connection. You know, I always believed in God and stuff like that, but I just didn't know how to access it. And when I came to OA, I felt like that there was that spiritual part which would be exactly what I needed, actually. It felt like exactly what I needed. So I started in, and I started working the steps, and I'm trying to think of what I should say about my first... I guess I believe that, you know, it's taken me a few times through the steps to actually really get what I can get out of them, and I think that I could keep doing the steps for quite a long time and still get a lot out of it. And but you know, you have to start where you start, you know what I mean? You just have to start and go and do it. And so I remember thinking that this is great, but how do I turn my life over? You know, how do I give my life over to God? I mean, that just seems so incredibly scary. And it's like, what do you mean? I mean, what do you mean? I'm not in charge. I'm not in control. And so that was the hardest thing for me during my first time through the steps, is step three, when I just thought, you know, yeah, I'm powerless. Yeah, I believe in God, but letting Him help me? I don't know. So, to me, that just took time and took practice, and I don't know. I guess the funny thing is one time when I was still in the midst of trying to figure it out, I had to have a colonoscopy, and so, you know, I'm a nurse, so I know about these things. You know, I know they give you Versed, and they give you what else? Versed and fentanyl, and the fentanyl is for the pain, and the Versed makes you not remember what happened. But I also know from being the nurse that you say funny things when you're on these drugs. You know, you're just chatting away to the doctor as he's doing whatever he's doing, and it's great for the doctor because you can still move around and stuff, and you can still cooperate, but you don't remember. So it's a good thing for the physician, and, you know, it's good for the patient too. But being a nurse, I knew I was going to be saying silly things. So I was having a hard time, like, giving that over. You know, I was having a hard time thinking, I'm going to go and have this colonoscopy, and I'm going to be, you know, the silly patient, not the nurse. And that made me kind of crazy. And I remember I was laying on the stretcher, and it was like a little late to be worried when you're on the stretcher already. But I was going, okay, God, I'm giving it over to you. You just, like, take care of me while I'm out. And that was the first time I ever, like, really tried to do that in my life. And I guess that's one of those things I'll just always remember, but even though, you know, it's kind of funny. But and then my way of trying to keep God with me was, as most of you in this room have heard of before, my little bathroom prayer thing that I do. And so I learned that because I was in school, and I was in classrooms and things like that, and it's hard to pray when you're in a classroom or you're with people. So, and I would get into situations where I would be angry. Usually anger was the first thing that would happen to me. Really pissed off at somebody about something. And it was inappropriate to just get mad. So I would go, okay, now what do I do? So I'd run to the bathroom. And then while I was in the bathroom, I would pray to God. I'd say, okay, I'm really mad at so-and-so because she said this and she said that. And then as soon as I got done praying to God about what was going on, then I'd say, what do you think I should do? And usually God would say, you know, you need to calm down. You need to, like, this is what you need to do. And I would just, like, hear what I needed to do. And then I would thank God, and then I would leave, and I'd be happy. And that worked for me. And so I kept doing it, basically. You know, when something works, you keep doing it. So... And plus, the thing is, I always have a soda. I always am having a drink with me, and I always have to go to the bathroom. It's embarrassing. I'm in a class right now, my structural equation modeling class, where if you miss something, if you go to the bathroom and he's still talking, you miss something, you know, that you can't miss, because then you come back and you missed it. Well, but I cannot wait. I cannot go 2 hours. I don't have a two-hour bladder for some reason. I never have. So anyway, I've spent a lot of time in the bathroom, so it works. It works for me, and it, you know, is a way to keep God with me, and, you know, it's a way of not just praying in the morning and the evening and wondering what the heck you're doing during the daytime, you know. So it's a way of really connecting with God. And My fourth and fifth steps, I have to say that they haven't been the like big momentous things in my life for my step work, really. My first time I did my fourth step, I was happy to do it. I was happy to tell my sponsor everything everyone else did to me my entire life and how horrible they were. You know, I just did the first columns and what happened and what it affected. Boy, I could tell you that. Just like, then she said, oh, you have to say, you know, like your part in it. My part? I had no part. No. So anyway, that was difficult. But really for me, I think the sixth and seventh steps were the ones that had the impact on me personally the most of anything. And so, you know, after you do the fourth and fifth, you know your part in things, and you start looking, like I had this list of character defects that would gag a maggot, you know. It was like huge list. And I'm like, oh my God, I do all these things. And so it's like overwhelming, you know. You're like, what am I going to do? But you just take one at a time, and you think about it, and you pray about it, and you find out, you know, what are some of the things that other people do when they have this character defect? What do I do? What are some things that are the opposite of it? And so you just explore it, and you kind of, you know, get used to it and kind of go through it. And then, actually for me, after I did that for the sixth step, I actually finally one day realized that about the prayer where it says, my creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, the good and bad. That made sense to me for the first time in my life. It's like, I am not just what I'm trying to project onto the world. I am not just, I am everything. You know, every part of me is what actually could be used in a way that God would use it. You know, like God uses our weaknesses as much as he uses our strengths, I guess is what I'm trying to say. And I didn't realize that in my entire life until that point. I'm like, what? God could use my weaknesses? And I'm like, yeah, because, you know, if you have struggled with something, you can help somebody else who's struggling. You know, how can you help them if you haven't experienced it? Or you haven't, you know, have no idea about it? So that idea of God, you know, taking the good and the bad and working with it as he would, to me, is what humility is. You know, it's the first time I had even the inkling of humility in my life, I would say. I was pretty prideful. And but that was a big turning point for me, because then I no longer had to, like, deny my character defects, but I could just embrace them and say, okay, so what happens when you pray into this character defect? What happens? How does God change that? How does it what does it look like? What is it changed into? You know, how could it be something bad end up being something good out of it, you know? So if you're stubborn and that's a bad thing, that you can be stubborn in a good way too, because you can keep working on your steps no matter what and be stubborn about it. And that persistence is a good term. Stubborn is a bad term. And, you know, if you change it into persistence, then to me that's God in it, you know. So that's another way of looking at the good and the bad. And so when I went through the sixth and seventh step the first time, I went through this this period of apologizing for everything. So I tell this one story that still makes me laugh, and I hope it makes you guys laugh a little bit. But so I was, you know, just new at this, and I was in the car on a trip with Justin, my ex-husband, and he could be very annoying. And so, of course, he would be annoying, and I'd get mad, and I'd yell at him. And then I'd apologize. I'm sorry. And then, well, actually what happened was we would be kind of arguing, and then we'd stop at the bathroom because I'd have to go, of course. Go in the bathroom, pray, figure out what I needed to do, come back out, apologize to him. 3 minutes later, I'm yelling at him again. And I'm like, oh, God damn it. So then, you know, the next bathroom, we do the same thing. We did this all across California, through the desert. And all play whoever whatever was after California, can't remember, but we just kept doing that. And the one thing that I learned through that is you know, I was trying to change myself. I thought if I apologized and I said I would not get angry again, then I would not get angry again. And God was telling me, no, I will help you. I will remove this character defect. You cannot remove it from yourself. Because I was like playing God, basically, thinking, well, I'm just going to fix it. So to me, that was a huge turning point, too, in to knowing that I could do the footwork, but I wasn't going to be the one to change things, that I was going to have to be patient, and I was going to have to let God do it when he was ready. And that was hard, but that's just how it is. And then the next part of the prayer where it says, I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character who stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. That was also a huge learning curve for me, where I wanted things to be removed from me because they made me uncomfortable about me. I wanted things to be better for me. I was very selfish still. And I just wanted things to be the way I wanted them to be, you know. I wanted to be happy, joyous, and free, but I didn't really want to do all the work that came along with it. So, realizing that, you know, that really thinking about God removing defects of character that stand in the way of your usefulness to others, not to yourself, was a big change for me of thinking, well, that's different, you know. And I read somewhere, I'm not sure where, I think it's in the big book here somewhere, but it says that if you pray at the beginning of the day for God to remove the defects of character that stand in the way of your usefulness, he will remove the ones that are the ones that you need to be helpful to others, but, you know, maybe not some of the other ones that are more just things you'd rather he'd get rid of for you. But so anyway, and let's see. So what am I doing? Time not to. Then the next thing I did was, you know, steps 8 and 9, which I think for a lot of people those are really difficult too. And I was actually pretty blessed with my amends, that they were pretty positive, and I guess I really struggle more with the character defects in my own self than the amends I had to make. But I did really, I was really scared to do it the first time, to do step 9. Step 8, where you have to say all the things you've done, wasn't so hard for me just to say it, but when you actually have to do the action of apologizing and talking to people, that was really hard. But I was, again, like I said, I was really blessed that the amends I made were positive. And then step 10, 11, and 12, I think step 10 is very useful to do, to, like, once you have things all cleaned up, to keep things cleaned up, keep things tidy. And I can't say that I do that every day, but I do a lot of journaling and I do a lot of 10th steps, just because it helps my peace of mind. It makes me feel, have more serenity. And I don't like, I really have gotten over the years, so to the point where I don't like it if I feel like I have hurt somebody's feelings or been abrupt with them or irritable or whatever. I don't like to just let it go, you know, over days. I like to just call and say I'm sorry or do whatever I have to do to make amends to that person right away. And I think that comes from doing the 10th step and being able to practice that. And, you know, if you have an amends to make, then making it is the way to go, really. Because then you feel better. Usually the other person feels better. And as far as prayer and meditation, I have discovered a new way of praying that I think is kind of cool. Well, actually, it's more like meditation. I do a lot of prayer, I must say. You know, I'm praying all the time. I'm talking to God 24/7 pretty much nowadays. he's just like kind of like a friend that's on my shoulder or somewhere right close by me, and I'm like going, do you think that's okay? Is we're doing all right? You know, I just check in with him, like, are things going okay? Or, you know, could, you know, ask for help, ask for guidance. Meditation, I have never been very good at. I've always been somebody that likes to be active and run around, and I just don't sit and calm, be in calm. I don't like to do yoga. I just don't like to be quiet. So I've been struggling with that because I know that, you know, prayer and meditation go together. So, and I used to pray and meditate while I went running, because I think running is kind of a rhythmic thing where you can pray and meditate and your mind can go to that place where it needs to go, but I can't run right now. So I have developed over this summer praying while weeding and meditating while weeding. And let me tell you, it really is nice because I kind of like to weed, number one. So, and usually, you know, it's hot and you have a little cricket sounds or whatever it's going on, and, you know, you're pulling the little weeds out, and it gives you a chance to just be with God. You know, just say, well, what do you think about how today went? You know, what do you think I should do next? Where do you want me to go? Which way should I go with this situation or that situation? And it allows you to have that time just to be with God and just to kind of check in with yourself and be quiet, although I'm still, you know, doing something. So it's easier for me to actually let myself be quiet in the moment while I'm pulling the weeds and things. And it's pretty mindless, you got to admit. So that is my newest and latest meditation technique, which works for me. And I think that's the point I'm trying to make with this, is it doesn't really matter how you do it. I think it just matters if you do it in a way that works for you. And everybody is different. Everybody has different things they like to do or things that help them or calm them down. It's good to know those things about yourself and then, you know, just let God into that and use that for your meditation or your prayer time. And boy, I talked a long time. So that's kind of what it's like today. And I'm just going to talk a few more minutes about today because I just think it might be good to talk about today. Right now, in time, I am not doing the best that I've done in program as far as being serene, having my food be clean and squeaky, and, you know, I'm just not doing perfectly good. But I'm not doing horrible either. And so what's going on with me right this second is that stuff that I told you guys about my early childhood. For some reason, I didn't get like that real bond with my mother that kids usually get, of feeling just loved and, you know, just adored for whoever they are. And so for some reason, I go around in life trying to get that in the present tense, which doesn't work, let me tell you. So I have these expectations sometimes of my friends and family that are, it's like my expectations are that they're going to be these perfect people for me, and they're going to meet all my needs, and they're always going to be just, you know, they're going to be that whatever I didn't get. So I've been struggling with the fact that in my therapy that I'm not going to get that. So kind of admitting I'm not, you didn't get it, and you're not going to get it. And it's not going to happen in the present tense, no matter how much you want it, you know. So because it's such a kind of like a deep-seated difficulty, it's not just a superficial thing, you know, it's pretty core to me. It's been rocking my food quite a bit lately, and I've been like sloppy in my food, and I haven't been non-abstinent, but boy, you know, I'm scared because there's times. The thing about it is, if I get sloppy enough in my food, then all of a sudden, chocolate cake just sounds like a great idea, you know? It's like, and I don't eat chocolate cake. So I'm just saying that more for myself than for you guys who are listening, just because it helps me to be honest, and it helps me just to say, you know, sometimes in program you're going along really good, and, you know, God puts in front of you what you can handle. So maybe I couldn't handle this before, and now it's time for me to handle it, you know, and now it's time for me to say, okay, with God with me, I can deal with this. I can accept it. And, you know, acceptance is the answer. It's not easy to accept sometimes, but it is the answer to all your problems. And so right now I'm just kind of hanging in there with my food and with my my non-acceptance of this issue. And I'm not, like, trying to force it to happen, but I'm trying to let God work on it in me. And I think it will. I have faith that God will work on it inside of me and help me with it. And, you know, sometimes things don't always stay the same. Sometimes there are hard times in your program, and but there's always, you know, any day in program is better than the best day out of program. You know, any bad, awful day in program is so much better than any of my great days out of program. So I will end with that, and thank you all for listening and being here tonight. Questions, anyone?
Jen? You said when you first came to OA, you thought we were all a bunch of nuts.
Mm-hmm.
Which yep. I can empathize with, because that was my reaction too. I want to know, was there anything pivotal that happened that really helped you put down your roots and mm-hmm. go beyond the, mm-hmm. oh my gosh, they're crazies, to, hey, these people
yeah.
might actually help me?
Actually, I remember this one guy who was, he was an AA also, but he was an AA and OA, and I was crying in a meeting, and it was, woo, and he came over to me, didn't really say all that much, he said, you're just right where you need to be, and he gave me a big hug, and I thought, oh, and I just felt like I was, you know, and I think things like that, people coming over and talking to you, I think getting a sponsor really helps you feel like you put down roots, too. Yeah. Yeah, thank you. Ms. Barb?
I have a couple questions.
Oh, good.
My first question, you kind of talked about doing your first steps,
mm-hmm.
And kind of based on, like when you said, oh, yeah, I can tell you all these things that happened to me, can you kind of talk a little bit about identifying your part in things when it really is a situation, you know, like with
when it is a bad situation.
When it is a bad situation,
yeah.
You justifiably are mad and angry.
Yeah.
And it,
okay.
Struggling through
yeah.
the process. And also maybe talking a little bit about kind of the higher power. You know, because you kind of talked about growing up, you were Catholic.
Yeah, okay.
Kind of
oh, okay.
working through that
mm-hmm.
as far as the reconciling it.
Mm-hmm, okay. So, the fourth step, I'm having trouble thinking of a thing, but let's see. Well, I had a lot of stuff on my first fourth step about my mom, because she, you know, was the instigator of me being my sister's savior. And so there's all these examples of me having to do stuff. Like, I didn't get to ride a bike because my sister couldn't ride a bike, you know. So I couldn't have a friend over unless they were friends with my sister. And if they didn't want to be friends with my sister, then I couldn't have that friend. That kind of stuff. And so I was mad at my mother for all these things, which, you know, on the surface are her fault. And as a child, I had no real recourse to do anything about it. You know, that's just the way it was. And I pouted through my childhood. I was always pouting. I pouted. I swear to God, I was pouting most of the time, because that was the only thing I could do. So, you know, if you look at your side of it, then you look at, okay, what do I do now that's similar to that? You know, how do I put myself in that same bind You know, how do I, you know, not stick up for myself in my marriage? Or how do I not, you know, say what I need to someone when I could? When now I could, then I wouldn't, you see? So that was my side of it, is all the things I did that carried on that kind of treatment of myself. So, you know, and, you know, pouting as a 40-year-old is really not attractive. Really not attractive. You know, and I would pout if I didn't get my way, you know? And so those were kinds of the kind of things that came out as my side, and then the character defects that went with it. So, and the, you know, the God thing is so weird, because my family, you know, being so messed up, my grandmother was my uncle's housekeeper, and he was a priest, and he had a small parish in northern Minnesota, and we would go up and visit for the summer, my sister and I, when we were like 10 and 11, starting until we were like 14 and 15, kind of like that. And my uncle was crazy. I mean, he was doing weird things. He was bringing men home from Europe. He was, you know, he was definitely having problems with drugs and alcohol and things. And everyone in the whole parish knew it except our family, which is, we didn't talk about it. And so things like that happened, you know, which were, made it really hard for me to, you know, still go to church and believe in the Catholic Church. And then, you know, fast forward till I was an adult, my mom and dad got divorced. My dad had never been Catholic. My mom was Catholic. My dad wasn't. But my dad married a woman who was Catholic, who was like the mirror image of my mother. Scary, scary thing. And then he became Catholic. And he annulled his marriage to my mom, because he wanted to be a Catholic. And so I took offense at that, you know, thinking, what does that make me? You know, if you annulled a 30-year marriage with three children, you know. So I was, like, really against the Catholic Church for those things. And I didn't think I would ever be able to resolve it, really. And so I didn't really, thing about it is I didn't really try to resolve it. I just tried to be with God. I tried to be with God of my own choosing and not of my religion, you know, and I just tried to be with God for years. And then, this is going to seem really weird, but recently I decided I really wanted to go to church, because I really wanted to have, it's hard to give to people when you don't know them, you know, and it's hard to give to people when you don't have a group that you give to. So I thought, well, if I had a church that I went to, then I could give back to people. Because I feel like I've been given so much, you know, that God loves me, and he's given me so much that I should be involved somewhere. And I had gone to a couple churches, and they just both happened to be Catholic. And I started, you know, I went to church because I wanted to sing in the choir. And so I give back by singing in the choir every Sunday. And I just take what I like and I leave the rest, and it works for me. And that way I'm able to give back, and I also get a lot out of it. So that's been kind of a full circle thing.
Any more questions?
Nope. All right. You're welcome. Thanks for asking questions. Thank you.